Welcome to the Somatic Primer Podcast with Bryson, an ongoing cross-discipline dialogue of all things somatics.
Hello, welcome to the Somatic Primer Podcast. I'm Bryson Newell, your host. This is a bi-weekly podcast where I invite guests on to discuss somatics, meditation, as well as movement traditions and practices. In this week's episode, I had the pleasure to speak with Joseph Alter. Joseph Alter is the director of the Asian Studies Center and professor of anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh. He's also the editor of the Journal of Asian Studies. His research is on environmental health, the globalization of Asian medical knowledge, and the cultural history of yoga's development in India. I want to thank all the listeners who are currently supporting the show. And if you're not already, then please consider supporting the show with a monthly donation and also by subscribing. As always, thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode.
I've been at the University of Pittsburgh now for close on 27, 28 years, and I've been teaching medical anthropology from the get-go. My area is India and South Asia, and I look at cultural history of Indian medical practices, but I teach about comparative medical systems in Asia generally. And increasingly, I take a historical perspective. I've done a lot of ethnographic participant observation in the areas of yoga, physical fitness, body practices generally, but I'm really interested in the cultural history broadly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So you were born in India.
That's right. I was born there. My parents were missionaries. My grandparents were missionaries. And I became an academic like my two brothers did as well. But we still have a family home in India. And that's part of the reason why I developed a research interest in India.
Sure. You grew up there, right?
That's right. From the time I was born in 1958 up until I graduated from high school in 1977. I went to Woodstock School, which is one of the premier boarding schools in India, an international school that draws students from really all over the world, even though it was established as a Christian missionary school.
Yeah. And is this by Dehradun?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's just up in the mountains on the first range of the Himalaya, right above Dehradun.
So I was living at Jongchub Ling about six or seven years ago. And a monk I was with, Konchok, took me to a market, and there was Indian wrestling. At the time, I didn't know what it was. He wanted to show me. I don't know if it was just coincidence or whatever, but I actually got to see that. And then when I read your paper, and oh, okay, now I know what I was seeing a little better.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, it's a very popular sport, but it's not one that is usually in the headlines or something that people who aren't looking for it find. So that's interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he just took me and stumbled on it. It was fascinating. I've heard from other scholars the similarities, or at least maybe like more modern yoga borrowed quite a bit from Indian wrestling.
Yeah, that's really an interesting issue because you're absolutely right, but it's counterintuitive for many people who do contemporary yoga, which, you know, with the postural techniques and the breathing exercises tends to be associated with sort of relaxing modes of self-care, rather than athletic physical fitness. And yet the athletic physical fitness of Indian wrestling and the regimen of exercises associated with that is really grounded in the same philosophy and really is keyed to the same principles of self-development and body practice. So you end up with a very different looking body depending on which track you take. But fundamentally, they're the same.
Mm-hmm. I remember I read a book, it was a biography on Krishnamacharya, and he said that wrestling was one of the best things you could do for your body.
Interesting. I wasn't aware of that, but it makes perfect sense. I mean, Krishnamacharya himself was very much an athlete and you know, integrated in wrestling. Sri Yogendra over in Bombay, who established the Yoga Institute, was a wrestler as a young man. Swami Shivanand of the Divine Life Society was an athlete who engaged in wrestling and was very interested in that dimension of the sport. And so that there are a lot of overlaps, even though, again, counterintuitively, many people who are drawn to the spirituality don't see that, or they don't let themselves see it.
Yeah. Yeah, it reminds me a lot of, more Eastern practices of like the Gong Fu Tai Chi stuff, where it's like they're combining these more martial practices with the spiritual practices, which you wouldn't think, but in that culture makes perfect sense.
Right, right. No, the subtle body power that a number of scholars have written about when they focus on Tao Yin and Tai Chi, and Jeffrey Samuel's work in particular kind of brings that into sharp focus, whereby the kind of energized power and potency associated with those techniques can be expressed in martial form in terms of either defensive or offensive techniques for protection of self and community, or they can be internalized for a kind of psycho-spiritual, physiological experience that, you know, is worked out in the literature depending on what you read, but Hatha Yoga certainly orients itself towards that concern of internalized subtle body empowerment.
Mm-hmm. So this is something, because I liked how you talked about embodiment and how the practice, you know, the person embodies it and it creates these internal kind of the subtle body stuff, but then also like the mental thing too. You see yourself through this whole lens. So the practice shapes the individual. And this is very, this really reminds me so much of the martial arts in China. But then do we see that though carrying through in the modern yoga?
Yeah, that's a good point and something that I think people have very different views on. So yes and no. And yes, in the sense that I think that those who take a broad view towards yoga and the physical practices see the points of connection and can sort of develop along those lines without trying to make distinctions that kind of draw them away from the points of connection between the martial arts and spirituality and psychic development. But I think as a consequence of yoga's popularity as a wellness technique, I think that the difference has been magnified as a consequence of its commercialized popularization. Which in many ways is exactly the same thing that's happened to the martial arts. I mean, you know, all of the studios that provide training for kids who go into karate and kung fu, it's wonderful. And you can have a path there that is really focused on self-development. But at the same time, it's commercialized popularity that sometimes gets disconnected from that more holistic sense of well-being and development.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, it strikes me as like just reading your text on the Indian wrestling, you know, you'd see the same thing in these other disciplines where it is a lifestyle. It's not like a drop-in class a couple times a week. It's like your whole day is oriented towards this. So the actual physical part of the wrestling is one bit in a larger idea, a bigger framework.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. And that is a point of connection to yoga as well, because the literature and practitioners of yoga point out that, you know, just doing a very specific technique of breathing or mindful concentration or asana posture is valuable unto itself to whatever extent you practice it. But the bigger encompassing whole really constitutes a whole way of life, ranging from all of the yam and the niyama techniques of self-discipline and self-purification, which run the spectrum from, you know, how and when you go to the toilet in the morning, how you sleep at night, what your mental state is when you encounter other people, how you comport yourself in public, and your character traits as they develop. So it's not something which can be reduced down to, okay, I'm going to do it for an hour and then I'm not doing yoga anymore. It's something that ideally should expand to encompass your whole being.
Yeah. So this idea of fitness takes on a much bigger idea. It's full mind body fitness in a real way.
Yeah.
When I read your text, it reminded me more of like when like Hatha Yoga Pradipika, like one of these, you know, like the discipline, the daily practice is almost like very similar, so similar.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's hard to know, you know, from a historical perspective, how it was institutionalized in practice. But it seems to be that the texts from, you know, the early medieval period assume that it's a form of discipline that is comprehensive and can be oriented towards transcendence and world renunciation. But I think that there's a very real sense in which it can become the basis for your health and well-being, regardless of which stage of life you are in and what your responsibilities in social life are.
Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing that's so, you know, that I think sometimes gets left out. It might not be overtly written about all the time, but because it's coming from a culture, there's certain ideas of renunciation and transcendence just in the culture already. And so these disciplines exist in that. So when you extract a method out and introduce it into a new culture, it takes on a whole new meaning.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's very true. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges for practitioners of yoga and forms of self-discipline that are associated with the philosophical traditions coming out of South and East Asia, is that they're not grounded in a kind of binary, certainly not the binary of mind-body, but they aren't grounded in a binary of distinctions in any sense. And so that the ultimate orientation towards practice is for it to become more and more encompassing and holistic rather than delineated. I mean, if you take the Bhagavad Gita as an example, you know, one way of reading it is to read it as a text about spirituality, but it's a text about war. And so if you're forced into a spirituality war distinction, you're understanding it in a wrong way, because what it's trying to do is bring those two things together in a way that is very challenging for, you know, everybody in an enlightenment frame of mind that makes these kind of binary distinctions. It's very hard to reconcile with that.
So you talked about, you referenced the idea of the mind-body duality understood there. So what does this mean? This takes us like into like embodiment stuff. So could you sort of, what's your view on that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you get away from the mind-body duality, what you focus on and are engaged in are practices of embodiment that encompass your what we would call state of mind, or your character, or your personality, and your appreciation of art, and you know, everything that tends to be conceptualized as very minded and oriented towards ideals. Mm-hmm. And it's not as though the mind-body, the reducing or eliminating the mind-body duality then brings everything down to a kind of materialist sense of reality. But it's one that doesn't see that duality and that distinction as being the guiding principle to how you think, quite literally. And so it's like thinking with your mind-body together, rather than just thinking through the ideas that come to mind in order to resolve the problems of the body. So it has deep implications for health and mental health and experiential techniques for reducing mental stress. And that's, I think, one of the most important things to see in these forms of practice, to see in yoga.
Mm-hmm. So if we're not just, how do I even ask this question? Like, how do you go about using the mind body to solve a question, solve a problem, rather than just conceptualizing through it?
Yeah, that's something that I don't have an easy answer for, because, essentially, I think the way I think about it, rather, let me put it that way, is that yoga philosophy very clearly states that even the purest ideas that you have, say a concept of God, mm-hmm. is fundamentally a material construction of how you are in touch with the environment. In other words, the environment and your perception and your body are really one as a consequence of their directly identical form. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of God is not just an abstract idea. Mm-hmm. It's something which takes shape in your brain as an aspect of the material that connects your mental sensibility to that idea. Mm-hmm. And that's true for the purest ideas as well as to the most base ideas. Mm-hmm. And so embodied practice is a useful way to be able to see how those kinds of ideals aren't just binary opposites, but how you can get through the experience of your perception of the material world to realize that kind of God consciousness or transcendence of the things that we experience that produce suffering in the Buddhist sense.
The concept is like the perception is like a concept, like a symbol, and then so the body communication would be like sensation, sensory, like how we behave in that environment.
Right. Although to an extent, from a strictly yoga perspective, at least the yoga that comes out of Samkhya philosophy, symbols themselves are a form that is grounded in the materiality of prakriti. And so our assimilation of the symbol itself is a kind of material internalization of the possibility of what it means in the abstract. So the symbol reality duality doesn't really work either. But it's a useful way to conceptualize it, yes.
So the symbol will change over time as your maturity in the practice changes, as you embody.
I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah, exactly. It becomes more refined. It becomes more pure in terms of its inherent meaning, as mm-hmm. well as its manifestation within the domain of Prakriti, which is inherently unstable, but can get purer and purer and purer as you work through it in the practice of yoga.
Well, that's wonderful. I really like that. That's a nice way you put that. Yeah, so we don't just get stuck on a elementary idea. We continue to develop it through, and the and interacting in the embodied state continues to help that evolve forward.
Right.
Makes that.
And it can, you know, the experience of a practitioner who just starts out, it can be very disappointing, because our ideals are always far beyond what our practice is. And yet, if you can grasp the sense in which practice is always incremental towards that purification, then everything you do is incrementally leading to it. And the more you do it, the more you experience it, and it kind of has the momentum of its own development. So it's not like suddenly you're going to be enlightened.
Right.
But there is that possibility. But the point I'm making is that there's a connection through that isn't quite that revelatory.
This word embodiment, how do you define or talk about or explain what this is? What does this mean, embodiment?
I think the embodiment is, I think the best way that I can think about it is to not complicate it too much. That is, to not assume that it's something that you don't inherently experience or feel. Mm-hmm. But its embodiment is a sense in which you sort of develop your sensibility to both material, physical sensations, to use that term, and your sort of spiritual and your social sensations, and to be able to sort of feel the experience of all of those seemingly different things within the domain of, you know, well-being, that is essentially what the asana are about. You know, the asana are positions that enable you to achieve that kind of connection across the sort of unconscious physicality of our day-to-day lives.
Mm-hmm. So it's a sensation, it's sensory.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Now, immediately I can hear sort of colleagues saying in the background, wait a minute, that's not right. Because it's not sensory in the sensory gratification sense, but it's sensory in the comprehensive sense of being able to feel the non-duality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's something interesting here too. So if I'm in my body, like I can locate a point of reference, like my back or my head or my hands or feet. But then there's also this capacity where there's a fuller sense where the mind can encompass and inhabit all the sensations of the whole body. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when we say the gratification thing, it seems to be a little smaller, the orientation times like a tasting food or something just on the tongue, where this takes, we have to kind of be more broad in our mind. Like it's kind of a skill.
Yeah, it is definite. It takes practice, you know, and that's what sadhana is practice towards that experience. Mm-hmm. So it's not confusing kind of the preoccupation with gratification in a sort of a minimalized sense, but it's broader than that and more encompassing in terms of its multidimensionality and its comprehensiveness.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is why this term is so confused, because it's hard, like, you know, hard to get at it.
And I mean, you know, one going back to the wrestling as similar to but different from yoga, the experience of the wrestlers with whom I worked, was that they would engage in this intense physical exercise for hours and hours and hours. And at the end of it, they would be exhausted, but exhilarated. So if you combine exhaustion and exhilaration, it kind of captures that sensibility of a duality that no longer exists as a consequence of that kind of embodiment. And it's comparable to the experience of sort of energized physicality that emerges out of sort of the yoga practice, similar but different.
Yeah. I mean, you can see why, like, the war metaphor is interesting here, like the exhaustion, like you're everything, you have to be fully focused, you know, you don't, there's no room for air, and then you better give it every bit, and then you're just wiped out.
Right. You know, and within the martial arts too, sort of the techniques that employ archery, for example. I mean, archery is a form of, you know, blurring the distinction between motion and stability and concentration and release. Mm-hmm. And sort of the perfection of that art involves an ability to not get preoccupied with achieving one by doing the other, but bringing them together in a single sort of experience of seeming incompatibility.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. It takes a great deal of concentration or mindfulness, mental effort to achieve these things, these body states.
Yeah.
So you were talking. You have comparative. You're doing comparative studies on different health practices or medical traditions in Asia. Mm-hmm. We can, if we look at, like you said, the Daoyin and the different practices in China and the channels, and then in Hatha Yoga, we have channels and we have Qi, and then we have Shakti and Prana. Are these shared traditions? They just happen to arise, or are they talking same things, similar, difference? Could you sort of help suss that out a little bit?
Yeah, there are very different views on that. And I think sort of very empirically oriented historians will always say that there's really not enough evidence to demonstrate that they are shared traditions that have developed through the exchange of ideas. But there are others who say, look, these traditions are different in practice. And you know, Livia Cohen points out that Daoyin really isn't like yoga, and yet there are similarities. And so it really pushes the question of what you're looking for when you're looking for similarities and differences. But the bottom line, I think, is that there were inevitably points of important cross-cultural communication, probably in the 6th and 7th century, when, you know, the monks were in motion through the various trade routes that connected east and south. But the frustrating thing is that at that point in time, there's very little evidence for an elaborate tradition that might have been shared. There are very suggestive sort of terminology that's used in discussions of philosophy, but there's really not enough solid evidence. And then, you know, maybe in the 12th and 13th century, after Hatha Yoga had really sort of developed into what many people recognize as a flourishing tradition, there may well have been connections, you know, up through the Northeastern corridor into Shaolin and that area up there. But again, there's not enough evidence. And then the biggest problem is that in the modern period, national identity has co-opted culture to the point that countries like India and China will claim those traditions and say, okay, yeah, we might have exchanged ideas in the past, but this is our heritage. And that tends to separate out rather than allow for a real historical study of the interconnections. But my money's on the interconnections, quite frankly.
So still, though, it's interesting. So we have these ideas that we don't really find too much in the West, actually, like the prana and chi. So I've had people on who are like, you know, chi is just internal sensation. You know, people, different Kung Fu masters from China and stuff, they're like, that's what it is. And that's what you begin to work with. And it's harder to find hatha yogis to come on the show.
But it is. I mean, you know, the language exoticizes it.
Right.
But it can't be so exotic that it's something that only a yogi who is, you know, practiced in the Himalayas for 50 years experiences. It's much more general and generic in a good sense, in terms of this internalized sensibility that is available to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's what I find interesting here. So you have two different, you know, for the sake of conversation, two different cultures talking about essentially similar ideas and working with it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And so it seems like that's the vehicle that we would want to plug into for this to achieve what we're calling an embodied state. It seems like that would be the subtle body, the connector between the mind and the physical body.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's the South and the East. There's also the Mediterranean traditions, the Newman and the energy associated with breath in that context. So it is very much a transhuman experience. The language has been differentiated. Yeah. And then the language was probably exchanged as part of ideas that flowed in order to enable people to make sense of it in ways that they hadn't thought of before.
Yeah, that's right. And so what was the tradition you said in the Mediterranean?
The tradition of Newman, I'm pronouncing it wrong, but it's the idea of breath and breathing.
Mm. So do we, so this is interesting too. Do we stop at the breath, or is it something more? Like, do we use the breath to tap into this sensation or this energy, or is it just the breath? Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it has to be more.
Yeah.
And there are different ways in which the language characterizes that. For example, in yoga, pran and vayu are kind of two dimensions of a duality of the subtle and the gross. So that to breathe is a gross, in a physiological sense, exercise that can be conscious or unconscious, but pran is how it moves from the gross to the subtle domain. Mm-hmm. And so breathing as a very generic practice is something that through skilled development can transform the gross into the subtle. Mm-hmm. But that's only within the framework of the yoga tradition in some articulations. And there are, I'm sure, I don't know them as well, but similar characterizations with regard to qi and, you know, practices of breathing in Tao Yin and other things. So it's air and breathing provide an experiential context within which then the language of how to describe it brings it into a sensibility that is not just the unconscious act of taking in air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the lungs are moving. So this is an exercise. It's a movement. We're creating, we're getting sensory feedback just from that. And then right. But then that would just be stuck in the chest, and we to move it into the limbs. And all these traditions are really focused on the, dantian, the vase, pelvis. So they're taking it further than just the lungs, obviously.
Yeah, it's, you know, the physiology then picks up where breathing enters, so to speak. That is where the breath is channeled. And then the channeling of the pran as it becomes subtle through the chakras is one way of articulating it. But it's all trying to get at the mechanism by which sort of the breath moves into the whole body rather than is just sort of stabilized in the lungs.
Yeah, so that's the key thing. And I think in the in a lot of our traditions in the West as they're building, that's the little bit we're struggling with.
No, you're right. I mean, it's struggling because I think that the sense of the body as a mechanical entity in the Euro-American traditions is so dominant that it's very difficult to articulate breathing in a way that isn't just mechanical. You know, it becomes something which is, you know, just hard to find the language to talk about it in a more holistic way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then when we hit this idea of embodiment, it's kind of, I think it's, we're the confusion is because of that. It's like, well, obviously I'm in a body and I'm thinking, but what these traditions are talking something more subtle that the mind can actually work with. Mm-hmm. They're more here. And if we see the body as just a mechanistic machine, you know, machines are devoid of that strong sensation.
Yeah. And yeah.
We talk sensation here. We're always called, you know, people are always confusing that with emotion.
Right, right, exactly. And that's why I think, you know, again, some of the practices in yoga and pranayama are especially useful for practitioners who are guided by this kind of mind-body duality. The Kapalbhati, which is the brain shining, you know, which is the easiest translation. Strike somebody as brain shining. I mean, what are you talking about? You know, polishing your car, and it's, you know, breathing in rapidly through the nose in order to cleanse what we would call the sinuses, in order to purify the channels so that the sensation of pran is that much more intense. Intense is probably the wrong word to use, but shining kind of conveys the way in which there is a very mechanistic dimension to some of the yoga practices that strike those who see it purely mechanically as, oh, I know that and it's not that important, so I'm just going to spend my time meditating. Mm-hmm. But Kapalbhati is intimately linked to that experience in a way that sort of the mechanistic dimensions of it don't capture.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That's really interesting. So if we're doing like a Kapalbhati or some pranayama practice, you know, as you said, it's like shining, but it becomes more clear to the practitioner, but like the concepts will get in the way because we got to switch into the sensory, the feeling. We got to feel it, and we get better at feeling and sensing, and we can enhance it over time.
Right. And it actually goes back to the point that you were making about symbols and symbolism, because many of the techniques of pranayama involve using the hand as a tool that can take the shape of a sort of a mudra, which is, you know, the positioning of, for example, these two parts of the hand to hold the nose. Now, a purely mechanistic view of it would be, well, if you're going to hold your nose, it really doesn't matter how you do it. But the symbolic significance of which finger combinations you use and what shape the hand takes as you perform that pranayama practice is really an experiential experiment with the symbolic significance of doing it intentionally and thoughtfully rather than just haphazardly. And it's, you know, haphazardness is the antithesis of sort of the practices of sadhana that are meant to enhance a holistic experience. So it's a good illustration of how symbolism connects to practice and meaning and the materiality of embodiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting, because the body now is becoming the symbol or doing the speaking, where the conceptual mind is not the in the fore.
Yeah.
So then essentially, like, you know, you become the thing, your body taking on this new dimensionality that's not the normal average sense of self.
Yeah. And, you know, the art historians who have studied the iconography of the Buddha and the characterizations of the Buddha's body point that out as well, which is that his body became the symbol of everything that we take Buddhism to represent, including those problematic dualities of a strong, fit, masculine body and the ungendered power that is associated with practice. And so you've got, you know, these things that don't fit into our normal conceptualization of starkly dualistic, irreconcilable differences. I think John Powers is the one who's written about that most forcefully.
So let me see if I understood. So you're saying the Buddha over his lifetime took on a more symbolic represent, his body changed somehow, or is that what you're saying, when during his lifetime?
I think that's one way to think about it. But I think that there's more evidence in the literature about the way in which his body is described. So it's hard to say whether his body underwent that transformation, but certainly the way in which the literature describes the body of the Buddha is one that doesn't fall into these dualities of the way in which we tend to see a monk's body as, you know, soft and passive and inherently prone to something that doesn't fit into the domain of violence. And it's not as though the Buddha was violent in any sense, but the potentiality of that is manifest in the literature, which characterizes him as an extremely powerful person. So it's power that transcends violence and nonviolence in a way that, you know, doesn't get complicated by that duality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he had a presence. He had a presence to him. And the power, the power of his being allowed him to, like, maintain his patience and his calm mind and not get rattled.
Right, exactly.
And we, you know, we find this a lot in the martial arts. So I remember when, as a child, you know, my sensei teaching us, like, you know, the best fighter is the one who doesn't get in the fight. If you can keep your cool, you'll avoid 99% of fights. It's right. When you're upset and scared, you know, you end up acting out of fear.
Right. Yeah. And you know, in one way of thinking about that I find useful is that you get to a point in the martial arts where it's not defensive or offensive, it's empowerment that is manifest in control.
That's right. Yeah. And so then that brings me back, I think, to the wrestling. It's like, you know, when we do the self-cultivation, we're breathing, doing asana like this, but it's different when you have an opposing force of another human being coming at you, like right. In the arts or the wrestling, and still being able to, though, maintain your calmness and, you know, even work through that in kind of a non-dual way where you and the other body become like almost one thing.
Yeah, exactly. And it goes back to the point that I was, that we were talking about with regard to the physical body as inherently identical to the environment within which that body exists. So if you have two bodies in an environment that share the substance of that environment. The mastering of the martial arts is reflected in an experience of the environment through the contact of those two bodies that is not framed by in terms of the sort of the distinction of the bodies, their combined power in that environment. And so, you know, being able to use that and you know, practice the martial arts with that experience as part of the dimensionality of embodiment is where it's really what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. So the power comes from the non-dual integration. And right. So the conflict of war would come from seeing yourself as separate.
Exactly.
Negative right. afflictions. And then the power comes from connecting. I always thought like when the Buddha attained enlightenment, he touches the earth.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I am this. This is me. I am it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and in Mahatma Gandhi's sort of experience of it, you know, his characterization of nonviolent political opposition to oppression was militant nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And militant nonviolence is exactly that in its perfection. Mm-hmm. And many would say that, well, you know, because it's never perfectly done, the imperfections stand out. But Gandhi's ability to bring about social justice and sort of the revolutionary independence of India is really based on that practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's and we still, I think a lot of times the conflict, and we still think peace is there's a weakness there. It's lacking power.
Right.
I remember I was in Rishikesh and there was an Indian storekeeper who was talking to me and he said, "We want peace." And the way he said it, he was like, "No, we want peace." It was like a strength coming from him. Like, mm-hmm. It wasn't like a backing down. He was like, "We're going to have peace. Like, it's going to right. be not like, oh, please be peaceful."
Yeah, right. And I think that it's a very different way of understanding the embodiment of the possibility of peace as very different from a kind of sort of reclusive separation from the world kind of peace. And it's, I mean, this issue is, I think, really at the heart of the way in which a number of spiritual teachers in India are very critical of absolute and comprehensive world renunciation. Because what that does is it creates a peace of transcendence. But what's important is the practice of peace in the world, or the practice of a kind of control to produce peace in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's a sense of almost running away, like I can be peaceful when nothing's in conflict if I'm over here. But maybe that's okay for a time in training. I'm plugging, but then I think sometimes the Buddha, I've heard like the Bhagavad Gita was kind of, I don't know if there's any truth to this, but it was almost a response to Buddhism in a way, to the monastics. But as far as I understand, the Buddha was very much in the village life. Like they would knock on doors, they would walk from town to town. He would do his yearly or during the monsoon, the retreats and whatnot. But generally it seemed like he was pretty social.
Yeah. No, I think that really is an important dimension of sort of the Buddha's historical presence that tends to get overlooked in the search for something that is so mystically exotic that it's hard to reconcile with sociality. Now, that's not to say that there's not an important difference there, but I think that scholars like Don Lopez have really drawn attention to the way in which it's problematic to sort of over spiritualize the Buddhist experience, and it's really important to ground the development of the ideas in a social history of those ideas, not to undercut them, but to ground them in a context that is meaningful.
Yeah, exactly. And this is what I was, I think the same thing can be applied to these ideas like chi and prana and these ideas. It's like, this is not something we need to overthink. It's there and it's available. Otherwise, people don't have any hope.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
What would be your advice or piece you would like to see implemented in the West with Western practitioners of embodiment traditions? Like, what do you think we can glean from these traditions that we haven't so far?
I think the way in which I would answer that is that if commercialization can be removed, or that there can be a separation of the commercialization and the preoccupation that I think many practitioners in the world generally, but certainly in our part of the world, that is North America, with individual self-satisfaction, and the goal of being your best self, which is not bad, but what it does is it turns the whole set of practices of embodiment into kind of a self-centered practice and goal. And the self is important, but I wouldn't place that as the point of reference for the achievement of the goals, because it produces a very skewed sense of reality, which in my view is connected to the social world, no matter how complicated that is. And so the answer to your question is to put embodied practices into a socially grounded world that is not dominated by commercial priorities.
Mm-hmm. And do you have hope for that?
Yeah, I think so. I always have hope, but optimistic. But I have hope precisely because I do not think that self-centeredness and commercialization will be so dominant as to eradicate the value of anybody's experience. If you take the most commercialized, self-centered experience, and I won't name names, but we could pull names out of a hat of those who sort of have pursued that route. That's not inherently bad, because to put it in this bad-good duality just sort of eliminates the possibility of being able to extract something of value from everything. And yes, there are better ways of doing it, but nothing is so inherently bad that we might as well throw up our hands and give up the ghost.
Yeah. Just the fact that these practices have washed up is, I think, reason for hope. And whatever they're currently taking, they need to they'll mature.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, is there anything else?
No, I think that's it. Really, I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I spend most of my time glued to my computer writing, but talking about it is always incredibly valuable, and that's why I love teaching. And so hopefully this has been a useful exercise, and I've certainly enjoyed it as a consequence of the opportunity.